9 o'clock, so let us begin. Hopefully we won't have some of the problems we had last time. Tech support is listening, so I can just say that one of the issues, hopefully we won't have it, the sound was the problem, but for some reason sometimes the screen just becomes a full screen and my picture disappears, so hopefully that won't happen. One or two comments from last class. One of you wanted to know whether I could do classes on Rav Chanoch Aegis, the Marcheshes, who we spoke about. Certainly an interesting personality, although the problem is that we don't have a biography about him, so I don't think you can actually do a whole lecture on him. He is, as I mentioned, a Shebe Gaonim. I will say, however, that he is killed in the Holocaust, incidentally. His son attended the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary for a time. So again, you see, get a sense of who he was, different than the typical Gadol. I also want to say, because I was asked questions about this, a point, why didn't all the Gadolim join the Aguda? We're going to see today more about Agudas Yisrael. You have Rav Chaim Moser Grzynski, you have many other important figures, and that some didn't. Even the Marcheshes, Rav Aegis, after he left Mizrahi, because of what last week when Mizrahi backed Rubinstein, because after all, they wanted Mizrahi Rav, and Chaim Moser was not, he never joined Aguda. There's really a few reasons why great figures did not join Agudas Yisrael. I'm not talking about the Hungarians now. They didn't join because they thought Aguda was making too many compromises with the Zionists. But there's a few reasons why a number of great figures and many Rabbanim didn't join Aguda, even if they weren't Mizrahi. First of all, the obvious one is if you were a Zionist, you couldn't be Israel because Agudas Israel was officially anti-Zionist. When I say anti-Zionist, I don't mean necessarily that you're opposed to settling the land of Israel, although that could be the case. I mean that you're opposed to any involvement with the larger Zionist movement. So if you believe in cooperation with the non-religious as one group, for the betterment of the land of Israel, that is your Mizrahi, you wouldn't be a Aguda. There are those rabbis, though, who were not members of Mizrahi because they didn't want to have anything to do with the non-religious, and yet they were not part of Agudas Yisrael, and that's also for a few reasons. One is, if you believed in settling the land of Israel, if you're a real lover of Zion, although there were such people in Aguda, the Ger Rebbe or Rishon Zalman Meltzer, there were many who didn't want to be part of it because the fact is, Agudas Yisrael also had people who didn't think that Eretz Yisrael was an important thing and were not in favor of settlement. That was particularly the case for a number of the German Orthodox who were really anti-Zionist, and even people like Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, we'll see. His philosophy was really like a Satmar-type philosophy, not as extreme, but almost as extreme, and there was many Gedolim, take the Kovno Rav of Avram Shapiro, who was not Mizrahi, but was not a Aguda and opposed a Aguda more than he opposed Mizrahi. He didn't want to participate in events and conventions and things like this where he had to deal with people like Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who was who he thought was a real extremist. So you had people like that who didn't want to be involved. Also, you had those like Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik and others. He didn't like the German Orthodox involvement. German Orthodoxy was really the equal of Lithuanian Orthodoxy and Polish Orthodoxy. They were very involved. They were really responsible for structurally for the Aguda working. And from many of the Litvisher Rabbanim, to put the German rabbis, who were not at the level of the Lithuanians, to have them on the dais, and especially the way the Aguda was formulated, the conventions with points of order and all these sorts of things, like a very Western type of thing, many of the Rabbanim, they didn't want to be part of this. So just because you were a member, you're not a member of Aguda, doesn't mean you're Mizrahi. There's other reasons not to join Agudas Yisrael. The most important one, perhaps, would be, or I shouldn't say the most important, but the final important one, which I'll point out here, is what was going on in the land of Israel. We touched on it last week. W.C. Hoffman was on their level, but W.C. Hoffman was placed in the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. Had people like Yaakov Rosenheim and others, and Isaac Halevi, who were really running the organization, the day-to-day running of the organization. And also, you had rabbis in Eastern Europe who were upset that the Rav of Frankfurt, Rav Horowitz, Mordechai Horowitz, the Matei Levi, he was not permitted to be Israel on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. Because he was a member of a Gemeinde, a unified community which had Orthodox and non-Orthodox. Now, all the rabbis, we've said numerous times in Eastern Europe, were members of these sorts of communities. There you had the German Orthodox trying to say that these rabbis, like Rabbi Horowitz, were not real rabbis because they weren't separatists. That was problematic. And finally, what was going on in the land of Israel, as we spoke last week. At the end of the day, Agudas Yisrael, when you look at the history of Agudas Yisrael, that has to be included as part of their history. Ritzvi Yehuda Cook was invited to the Agudas Yisrael convention in the 50s, and he refused to go, saying that Agudas Yisrael shortened his father's life. He thought they had blood on their hands. Now, what does that mean? I'm not saying this about Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski, about the Chavetz Chaim. He's not even saying this about Yaakov Rosenheim. But the Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel were the real extremists, and the German Orthodox people, like Rosenheim, had back and forth letters to Moshe Blau in the land of Israel. He didn't know what to do with these crazies, and Rav Chaim Moser and the rest. And yet, at the end of the day, these people were part of Agudas Yisrael, because Rav Sonnenfeld and the separatists were part of Agudas Yisrael, and the crazies were in their community. And they never threw them out. So at the end of the day, the world of Agudas Yisrael, they didn't know what to do. They were horrified by what was going on, but these people were associated with the Agudas Yisrael, just like if you saw today, rocks thrown at Eli Yishai and all these other things. These people were involved with the Eda Haredit and other Haredi extremist groups. But the group itself has to take some sort of responsibility because they don't speak out against it. So had many Rabbanim who thought that Agudas Yisrael not speaking out strongly enough, and if you take people like Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, when they go to the land of Israel, they're not involved with Agudas Yisrael anymore. They were Aguda outside, when they were outside the land of Israel, that's the organization that they were most sympathetic to when they were Agudas Yisrael. But in the land of Israel, Agudas Yisrael was dominated by real extremists. As I said, and I'll end it with this, if you want to get a sense and understand what it was like in Agudas Yisrael, in the land of Israel, just you have to look at what's going on, these crazy protests and everything. These are the sorts of people who were the Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel. Now, someone asked me privately, the Lubavitch position, Lubavitch also opposed Agudas Yisrael, both because they thought they were maybe compromising on the Zionist aspect, but also because of the German influence, and I think most fundamentally that Lubavitch does their own thing always. So I'm going to be in Ranana this Shabbos, and I'm speaking on Rav Goren, so let me just share one thing which I didn't mention in my classes on him, because, look, you can't speak about everything, but there's always going to be talk in Israel about Gilad Shalit, and I just want to tell you what Rav Goren says, because it's worth knowing. There's a law, it's a halacha, it's not just a nice thing, that we're not supposed to redeem prisoners more than they're worth. What does that mean, more than today, I don't know if you can determine that as much as in the olden days, slaves would be ransomed and captured people would be ransomed, so you had a basic idea how much someone is, quote, worth. And the reason we don't ransom someone for more than they're worth is because it'll just encourage more kidnappings. By the way, as far as I know, I could be wrong, but as far as I know, all the poskim who've ever dealt with this, well, let me take that back. The poskim that I know who dealt with this assume that this doesn't apply to the family. This applies to the community. That is, the community can't give $100 million for one person. There's limits. But an individual, if it's your family, or if you as a, I don't know if it's as a private individual if you could give more, but everyone who I've seen who dealt with it assumes that a parent, for example, could give more than the normal amount to get back one of their children, even though this might encourage other kidnappings, that as parents and children and family members are not bound by it. I don't know what the halacha is, what they say about an individual who's not related, whether that also you'd have the, I assume it's a machokas, like all these sorts of things. But a community has is not permitted to pay more. Okay, tech support, if you can just get rid of Edward Shapiro's picture. Rav Goren discusses about a prisoner from the army. He makes the case, it's in his book, Farata Medina, which describes various halachot dealing with the state of Israel, how to run a state. And he makes the case that soldiers are separate, they're different. Soldier, every time he goes out, puts his life on the line, assumes the risk. And therefore, there's a contract between the community and the soldiers, and the community is obligated to put its life at risk to free the soldier, it's just like the soldier puts his life at risk. And therefore, the army has to do whatever is necessary. The government has to do whatever is necessary to get back the soldiers. That doesn't mean that they just go crazy over this, but there is no rule. If the government is able to get someone back and it costs more than you would for a civilian, that's fine, because there are no rules as to how much ransom a soldier for. That's worth noting. Okay, let's continue with Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. We ended last class. The last thing I mentioned was the terrible miscalculation of Mizrahi. We understand why they did this. Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski, although he was great gadol, I don't think you can call him gadol hador in 1928. He'd become that in the next decade, but certainly a great sage. And they wanted a Mizrahi Rav. Why should they let... It's not like Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski was an independent. There were rabbanim, like the Kovno Rav, who were not involved in any party. And Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, by the way, says that any community Rav should be above politics and should not be in any organizations. He shouldn't be in Mizrahi, because he should represent everyone. Obviously, he has his own private views, but he should not be involved officially in any of these organizations. And that was the position in many of the yeshivas in Eastern Europe. Chaim Moser Grzinski actively involved in Aguda, and the Mizrahi, I don't know if it was the national office, but at least the Vilna office thought that if Chaim Moser wants to be, fine, but we're going to elect a Mizrahi leader. But Chaim Moser, as I mentioned, was not typical Agudist. He was such an outstanding sage that there was a lot of outrage in the world, including Rav Agus, who was a Mizrahi figure, was on the Beis Din, maybe the second or third most important Rav in Vilna, maybe the third most Rav, you could say, certainly the second and most important in Vilna. I don't want to say the third most in Lithuania, but one of the great poskim. He wasn't just a Rav, he was a postseg, and Lithuania didn't have that many poskim. Aren't known more for the great Rosh Yeshiva by the time he gets to the 20s and 30s. And I mentioned how even Rav Reines' son-in-law, Rav Aaron Rabinowitz, abandons Mizrahi after this. Now, in the Sefer, Imre Schaefer, we spoke about with Rav Avram Shapiro, the stories and the oral teachings of Rav Avram Shapiro, on page 251, it has something which I think is incredible. And I think it answers a problem which I had for a long time. It's page 251, it quotes Rav Yeshua Magnus. Rav Yeshua Magnus is one of the Rabbanim at Merkas HaRav. He was very close to Rav Avram Shapiro, and I think the information I'm going to share with you now must have come from Rav Avram Shapiro, because how would Rav Magnus know about this? Rav Avram Shapiro claimed that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav's father, supported Rubinstein, and that people wanted to put him in Cherem because of this. But Rav Baruch Ber Leibovitz stepped in. Why it keeps opening up like that. Rav Baruch Ber Leibovitz stepped in and stopped it, saying one doesn't put the Rebbe's son in Cherem. Now, the first point, I can believe that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was against Rav Chaim Moser for the rabbinical position for a couple reasons. First of all, when he joined the Tachamoni, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik taught at the Mizrahi school in Warsaw. And when he did that, many of the Lithuanian Rabbanim turned against him. When I say turned against him, they were very upset with him. There were other Rabbanim, Lithuanian Rabbanim, who taught in Mizrahi schools, but the Agudistin, especially the followers of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, they were very upset with this, because Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was well known to Mizrahi. He thought Mizrahi was a terrible thing. He thought Rabbi Reines had really lost any standing as a Talmud Chacham and Gadol B'Yisrael. And to have Rav Moshe Soloveitchik teach it with the Mizrahi, that was too much for them, and they were very upset. It turns out that another of Rav Chaim's great students, the Mechitor, from Apolichek, he taught in Lida at Rav Reines' yeshiva. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was much like the Rav, his students, even his son, often did their own thing. And there's an interview in the paper from the early 1920s in which Rav Moshe Soloveitchik speaks very negatively about Agudas Yisrael and quotes his father, how his father was very opposed to it. Now, you find in number of sources that they state that it's rabbinic sources written in recent years that when Rav Moshe Soloveitchik joined the Tachamoni, Gadolim of Eastern Europe, the Aguda Gadolim, wanted to put him in Cherem. And this never made any sense to me. What do you mean they wanted to put him in a chayrim? So he taught at Mizrahi school. There are plenty of great Torah scholars who taught at Mizrahi school. Both great Torah scholars who were Mizrahi, and also great Torah scholars who weren't Mizrahi, but they figure it's a job or they're teaching Torah. If Yeruchim Gorelick could teach at YU, and I'm going to come back to that in my next Sfarim blog post, certainly other Rabbanim could teach at the Mizrahi school. So why would they want to put him in chayrim? The whole thing never made any sense to me. But now, and I'm assuming it's correct, by the way, because it's repeated in numerous places that they were so angry at the Ramosha Soloveitchik they wanted to put him in chayrim. Now I understand, I think, why they wanted to put him in chayrim. It has nothing to do with the Tachkamoni school, and as I said, that would make no sense. It's that Ramosha Soloveitchik turned on Rav Chaim Ozer and supported Rubinstein, and that is an offense to be put in chayrim. I mean, to go against the entire rabbinic elite, against the Chafetz Chaim, and they all came out against Mizrahi for this. And assuming this is true, and Rav Shapiro has very good history of knowing these sorts of things, if Rav Moshe Soloveitchik would diverge so sharply from the rabbinic elite to go against Rav Chaim Ozer, that I can understand why they'd say he should be put in chayrim. And of course, then Rav Baruch Bar Leibovitz says you don't put the Rebbe's son in chayrim. What I think happened was that there was this tradition that the Gedolim wanted to put Rav Moshe Soloveitchik in chayrim, and people didn't know why. The idea that it was because he supported Rubinstein wasn't well known. So most people, what do they know about Rav Moshe Soloveitchik in Europe? They don't know anything except for the fact that he taught at the Tachamoni, and the Rabbanim were not happy. So they assumed, they concluded, that that must be the reason they wanted to put him in chayrim, that he was teaching at the Tachamoni. And as I said, this makes absolutely no sense. But what does make sense is that they would want to put him in chayrim for supporting Rubinstein. And that's what I think happened, that people said that they wanted to put him in chayrim, not knowing why. They assumed it was because of Tachamoni. And the real reason is, like Rabbi Magnus said, that's the spiritual reason why they wanted to put him in chayrim, because, and that's what Rabbi Magnus reports, that it was Dafka because of this, supporting Rubinstein, that they wanted to put him in chayrim. Now, someone's sound is on. Sound at because I'm hearing a back sound coming back. Tech support can turn off someone's sound. There it is. Tachamoni also had secular studies. By the way, the Gerer Yeshiva in Warsaw also had secular studies. They objected to Tachamoni for a few reasons. So Rav Chaim Moser called it a Beit Charoshet, a rabbinic factory. They were giving smicha for people who were, it was sort of like a rabbinical type seminary. That's one thing. They had secular studies. That's another thing. And finally, because it was Mizrahi, and that they all go together, so you could choose your reason. Whatever the case is, as I mentioned, you have people who claim that it was because he was teaching at the Tachamoni that they were there, and that makes no sense. Lita also had secular studies, and the Machins are taught there, and no one ever thought of putting any of the other Rabbanim in Chayrim who taught at these sorts of yeshivas, but this makes a lot of sense to you, what I just told you. Now, since I mentioned Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein, let me just briefly mention his wife, Esther Rubinstein, who was really a great woman scholar in an era before you had women scholars. We have women scholars, or so they tell us we have women scholars. I guess there are a few. I would have been happier and more impressed if instead of Rabbi Avi Weiss, my employers, if he would be, instead of going ahead with all this business, Rabbah and everything, give it 10, 15 years. Want to support a women's kolo, a maharat kolo or something, you know, train these women, get real talmidei chachamim, and then do something. That I think is more important. But Esther Rubinstein was a great scholar, obviously studied with her father, who was Rav, published Sfarim. Yirmiya Flensburg was his name, including a commentary on Rav Chastai Kreskus's Or Hashem. You can see it in HebrewBooks.org. Even from this book, you see that he's not your typical East European gadol. Look in the back, the correspondence he has with Harkavi and with obviously from a very unusual family. She wrote articles in the Hebrew press. She had a beautiful Hebrew. She spoke Hebrew. She wrote Hebrew. If you read the stories about her, her father would ask her questions like, where in Tanakh can you find this? I mean, she's a real bucky. I don't know if she knew Talmud, really, like Forrest Sassoon, but a real bucky in Tanakh, backwards and forwards. Rabbi Weinberg, as I mentioned last week, has a wonderful eulogy. For some reason, I guess censorship, I'm not sure what other reason that could be. It's scandalous, but in the second edition of Leif Rakim and the third edition of Leif Rakim, this eulogy has been taken out. Beagle Eisen just told me that a new edition of Leif Rakim in two volumes, whatever that means, was published in Israel just recently, in the last few weeks. I'm not sure if they split up. The other volume is like 700 pages, I think, or 500 pages. They split it into two. I'm assuming they added more material. Maybe now, in the fourth edition of Leif Rakim, they decided to put back these things. I published Kitvei Rabbi Chirach of Weinberg, Volume 2, and I was going to include everything that they censored, they took out from Leif Rakim, the second edition, and right before it was going to go to press. And by the way, there's no reason to take anything out. So they could have just reprinted the entire Leif Rakim. Rabbi Weinberg published it, just reprint it. I already mentioned they took out the antinomian stuff that we spoke about last semester. But right before I was going to publish the volume, Leif Rakim third edition comes out, and 80 pages from my volume, my volume was going to be 485 pages, I think it is, I see that 80 pages in my volume they had included in the third edition of Leif Rakim. So I took out those 80 pages, although I spent a good deal of time putting them into the book and annotating them. I took them out, and then I published all the stuff which was still left out. Again, no explanation why anything is left out. And one of the things left out is the eulogy on Esther Rubinstein, who dies young. She dies at the age of 42 in 1924. She founded Jewish schools for girls. I mean, she really did incredible things. Those who are interested, I can send you the link. Schneer Lyman translated Rabbi Weinberg's eulogy last year, the year and a half ago. Her funeral was in the Great Synagogue in Vilna. I'm sure we all know that very rarely, I don't know if the coffin was brought in, so I can't say, but I can tell you that no woman ever had the honor of having her funeral in the Great Synagogue in Vilna. Generally do not bring coffins into a synagogue. We make an exception for exceptional people. I don't know whether it was brought in. There's no question if you went back, if someone's really energetic and want to go back to the Yiddish or the Hebrew press from 1924, you could probably see a description of the funeral. But she was the only woman ever given this honor. And as far as I know, she's also the only woman I know who had a traditional Sefer Zikaron published in her memory. There is a woman named Linda Miller who was a big philanthropist, and there's a Jubilee volume in her honor. To thank her for all the things she did. She's an American, and this came out, I believe, in the 30s, maybe the 40s. But I don't know of any other woman who had a Sefer Zikaron or a Sefer Yovel, and that is a woman who's deserving because of her own scholarship. Weinberg says as follows about Esther Rubinstein, who, as I said last class, is portrayed in Chaim Grada's Rabbis and Wives as still being alive in 1928 and really pushing her husband, Yitzhak Rubinstein, to take the rabbinate. And he was not so certain he wanted to do that. That's Chaim Grada's artistic license, and obviously also assuming that had she been alive, this is what she pushed. This is what Weinberg says. Had Esther Rubinstein been granted longevity, she would have aided us in solving the problem of Jewish education for women. For she regularly chastised Jewish women for frivolity, poverty of Jewish education. She left an indelible impression on her listeners and readers, for all know that she was the living embodiment of the complete Hebrew woman. Wonderful words. He describes going to see her together with her husband while she's on her deathbed and talking to her, how much Weinberg enjoyed talking to her, as did other rabbis. Everyone enjoyed speaking to her. Maybe that's the problem. The idea that you have a woman who speaks to rabbis and they enjoy her company and learn from her, maybe that's too controversial and they have to get rid of that. Okay, returning to Rav Chaim Moser Grzynski. He was, from the late 1920s, not even earlier than that, the address for all money sent to the United States, from the United States and Western Europe to help the yeshivas. He was the head of the Vadi Yeshivas. Spent hours every day, his money, he sent letters all over the world to rich American Jews. I've seen them, numerous letters. The people he sent it to could not understand what he's writing, but they knew, he knew they would get it translated. Letters to Chief Rabbi Hertz in England, letters to other people. he felt the weight of all the East European yeshivas on his shoulders. If you go to Yivo, they have the archives of the Vada Yeshivas, and you see all the yeshivas, the problems they had. And then there was the rabbis who had to be supported because their communities could not afford. These were the years of the Depression in the 30s. Rabbis in the Soviet Union were having difficult times. And Chaim Moser was really responsible for all this. He was really running Orthodoxy in Eastern Europe in an institutional sense. Everything went through him. It was he who discovered the Chazon Ish. In Vilna, the Chazon Ish was just a private citizen. He discovers him, discovers this great genius. Not just a genius, one with an insight. Rav Chaim Moser was a keen judge of character and intelligence, and he saw that the Chazon Ish was someone he could speak to, and he respected his intellect very much. He consulted with the Chazon Ish on all the important matters that came up. Then the Chazon Ish in 1933 leaves Vilna and goes to the land of Israel, and this troubled Rav Chaim Moser very much. He felt that he no longer had his confidant, but he writes to Rav Kook, and you can see the letter in the collected letters of Rav Chaim Moser. He writes to Rav Kook, tech support, that's what I'm talking about, these things just popping up. He writes to Rav Kook that a great man is ascending from Babylonia, a great lion is descending from Babylonia. And just to inform Rav Kook what sort of person is coming, he obviously expected Rav Kook to take advantage of the Chazon Ish and use him the way Rav Chaim Moser used him. And he says that this man who I consulted with in every issue is coming and you should look out for him. And Rav Chazon Ish, the first thing he does when he comes to the land of Israel is send two letters to Rav Kook to discuss halachic issues with him. Chazon Ish obviously regarded Rav Kook as the Mara D'Asra, as the Posek. He doesn't write a letter to the Eda Haredit asking them what to do about Trumos. That was what he was with. He writes to Rav Kook. But if Rav Chaim Moser thought that the Chazon Ish should become a confidant for Rav Kook and assist him in matters, that was not to be the case. The Chazon Ish does not settle in Jerusalem. He settles in Bnei Brak. Some people think he didn't want to go to Jerusalem precisely because of the disputes. And although Rav Kook and him had limited contact, Rav Kook came to Bnei Brak and spoke there. The Chazon Ish, we have a picture, he stands up throughout the entire talk. They did not have any real relationship after that. Rav Kook dies in 1935, after the Chazon Ish is only there a couple of years. And as the years go on and the Chazon Ish begins to understand Rav's ideology and what Rav's about, although he always respected Rav Kook, he did not see Rav Kook as standing in as an intellectual or a ideological companion. He saw Rav Kook as more of a revolutionary and did not support his ideology. In fact, he advised the local bookstore not to sell Rav Kook's philosophical works. His halachic works, 100%, fine, everyone should learn them. But his philosophical works, he thought, should not be studied, that they break with Jewish tradition. There, with regard to Rav Kook, and I mentioned Chaim Moser, you can look in the collected volumes, two giant volumes here, which probably only contain 10% of all the letters Chaim Moser wrote, if that even. There are loads and loads of letters from Chaim Moser to Rav Kook, which is not surprising, because Chaim Moser and Rav Kook were the two leading authorities in the world at the time. Rav Kook was the dominant figure in the land of Israel, the most important figure in Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Chaim Moser dominated Europe. There was also all sorts of political issues and halachic issues that the Gadol Hador in Europe and the Gadol Hador in the land of Israel need to deal with. Numerous correspondence. Rav Chaim Moser himself wanted to go to the land of Israel. He couldn't leave Europe, though. He thought that he was needed in Europe, and he could not go. See, Pesach Frank tries to convince him to come to the land of Israel. He said that only Rav Chaim Moser would be able to make peace with different factions. And when Rav Kook dies, see, Pesach suggests that Rav Kook come and become Av Beis Din of Jerusalem. That he wouldn't be chief rabbi, they were going to pick a chief rabbi, but Av Beis Din of Jerusalem. Chaim Moser was quite elderly at this time. He couldn't be chief rabbi even if he wanted to. Rav Chaim Moser turns him down, and then Tzvi Pesach becomes a chief rabbi. In 1935, Chazon Ish asks Rav Chaim Ozer to come to the land of Israel. And Rav Chaim Ozer says he can't leave Vilna. He feels a responsibility not only for the Vadi Yeshivos, but also for the Ramalei's Yeshiva. There was a yeshiva in Vilna. His brother was involved in this yeshiva. Then his brother passes away. And Rav Chaim Ozer feels a responsibility that without him, the yeshiva would fall apart if he was not there. They had seen what happened when Shimon Shkup came to America. His yeshiva was falling apart. So Rav Chaim Ozer says he cannot go to the land of Israel. And he also says in this letter that 2 years prior, that's 1933, he was asked by, quote, both sides to come to Israel. Both sides are the Rabbanut side and the Eda Haredit. A few years prior to this, that is prior to 1935, this was in 1930, I believe, or 1932, Ritzi Pesach Frank writes to Rav Chaim Ozer with a different plan. He wanted Rav Chaim Ozer to declare the separatist community, that is the Eda Haredit, which is the official Agudas Yisrael branch, that is Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel was represented by the Eda Haredit, which meant, very strange, Yitzhak Breuer in his autobiography mentions this, that when German Orthodox Jews would go on Aliyah, Agudistan, people like Yitzhak Breuer, who were intellectuals, doctorates, and philosophers, their rabbis, although it sounds strange today, their rabbis were rabbis in the Eda Haredit, Rav Sonnenfeld, Rav Tukachinsky. If they got married, they'd have one of these rabbis marry them. Now, these rabbis in the land of Israel were the strongest opponents of secular studies, the strongest opponents of leaving the ghetto. They were living the old backwards way that they had always lived. When I say backwards, I mean the sense that they're looking backwards, that they want to live the way their ancestors did for hundreds of years. They're not looking forward. They don't want progress. They want to live traditionally. Same clothes. They only want to speak Yiddish, no secular studies. And these German Orthodox are all speaking German. They believe in secular studies, all these sorts of things. And yet their community was the rabbis, the old-time rabbis. So that's obviously a great culture gap, which didn't last very long before I had to leave this group. What happened was the German Orthodox began opening schools. Chorev and all sorts of schools, the German Orthodox, and of course the canine extremists want to say you can't open these schools. And it didn't take long for the German Orthodox to realize that they have nothing in common with them. But Ritzi Pesach Frank was asking Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski to shut down Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel. Now, obviously he can never do that, but what was the point? Why was he saying that? He writes Rav Chaim Ozer that there already is a chief rabbi and a Beis Din. You have Ritzi Pesach Frank, you have official Berenstein, you have numerous gedolim on this Beis Din, and the Eda Haredit has no right to have its own chief rabbi and have their own Beis Din. The Eda Haredit opened up their own Beis Din. It exists to this day, by the way. Rav Moshe Sternbach is considered, I think, it's Zav Beis Din, and then you have another office called Gaonov Beis Din, which is Rav Tovia Weiss. I don't know who this Rav Tovia Weiss is. He comes from Antwerp. I mean, I know who he is. I've never heard anything about him in the realm of scholarship as anything outstanding. As far as I know, he's never published anything. Maybe he's more of the political leader. He's the one calling for all these riots and protests. But Rav Moshe Sternbach is an enormous scholar. How he ended up with this group, I have no idea. He comes from the Lithuanian world. He was very close to Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. He fought in all sorts of institutions, and towards the end of his life, he ends up with this group. When they asked him to join them, because he did become quite anti-Zionist, but his grandchildren were in Beis Yaakov. He had to take his granddaughters out of Beis Yaakov. So although he doesn't see eye to eye with all of the Eda Haredit, he is part of this separatist community. I think people should remember this when they quote him and when they refer to him as a gadol and all these things. They should understand he now is anti-Zionist. He opposes the state of Israel. And I think the way modern Orthodox Jews relate to figures who are anti-Zionists, who oppose the state of Israel, I think you have to relate to them a little differently than your normal mainstream Agudas Yisrael gadol. I don't think he's deserving any more of the same respect he used to have. Obviously, from a scholarly perspective, deserving of all the respect, but in terms of a leader of Klal Yisrael, and not at all. And it bothers me greatly when you see, for example, in England, you have a number of people there, because Rabbi Moshe Sternbach is English. He speaks English as well as all of us. I remember seeing in the Jewish Chronicle these rabbis who getting positions in England, and it says that they receive smicha, or they're students of Rav Moshe Sternbach. And that troubles me, to have rabbis of modern Orthodox communities who've been trained by anti-Zionist rabbis. I don't know. It bothers me a good deal. He was very close to the Brisker Rav, no question about it. And the Brisker Rav was an anti-Zionist. And Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg already in the 50s, he was anti-Zionist. He was trying to convince Zev Gold, head of the Mizrahi, to get him in a position at one of the yeshivas. And he says in this letter, the problem is that Zev Gold says that Moshe Sherbach is anti-Zionist. And Rabbi Weinberg says that in that he's right. He is anti-Zionist. But Rabbi Weinberg is trying to get Sternbach to keep his mouth shut and not express his anti-Zionism, because the fact is he was a great Talmud scholar. His books are of great value. And I do have to say, though, despite the fact that he's anti-Zionist, he doesn't show disrespect for the other rabbis who are not, even for Zionist rabbis, he doesn't show disrespect to them. So it's his ideological viewpoint. I find a problem with that viewpoint, but he is more open-minded, maybe because of where he comes from, than the others. But then this is the Eda Charedit. And I will say that the Eda Charedit, by the way, has to bear responsibility for what's going on today in Israel. They can, until they come and condemn them. If you haven't read the news today, these people threw rocks at Eli Yishai. It's only a matter of time before someone is killed. It's craziness. And yes, you're going to say these are Notre Carta, these are not really Eda Charedit. As I said last class, there's these incestuous relationships. They don't necessarily take orders from the Eda Charedit, but they're family members who are part of the Eda Charedit, and when they need Psak Halacha, they go to the Eda Charedit. So they have these loose ties. Now, if the Eda Charedit comes out and condemns them, then they might attack the Eda Charedit. But sometimes you have to do the right thing, and the Eda Charedit set these protests in motion by this nonsense that these bones in Ashkelon, first of all, that they're Jewish bones, which they're not Jewish bones, by this viewpoint, makes no sense at all that you can't move them to build a hospital. I mean, and they set this in motion, and every time the Eda Charedit calls for a protest, they know what they're doing. They're letting the inmates out of the asylum, because anytime these people go out and protest, you have violence. And therefore, they have to bear responsibility, just like they had, Ritzi Yehuda said, they had to bear responsibility in Rav Kook's lifetime, because these were people in their community shortened Rav Kook's life. So this is who Ritzi Pesach Frank was trying to shut down, the Eda Charedit. What happened in Israel today is Eli Yishai, he's the head of the Shas party, went to visit Rabbi El Yoshev, sitting Shiva for his daughter, and they attacked him with rocks, and they had to be evacuated. They're crazy, insane people, but they are part of a larger rubric of the separatist community. In other words, they are the crazies in the separatist community, just like the religious Zionist world has to control its crazies, and they do have to speak out about them. And if they don't, they don't bear responsibility. These Eda Charedit has to speak out for its crazies, and they haven't yet. If they do today, I mean, this is different. One thing to attack soldiers or policemen, I call them Nazis, but throw stones to attempt to kill a baby or injure a Haredi member of parliament, that's really crossing the line. I mean, the fact that they've beaten up plenty of people and thrown rocks, beaten up women. The head of the school my daughter's attending next year, Miriam Shear, was the first woman beaten up on a bus, one of these separate buses. They've beaten up young religious Zionist kids in Beit Shemesh. To do that, okay, they're Zionists. You can do that. A Haredi member of parliament dealing with insane hoodlums, basically hoodlums, terrorists. And the Eda Haredi has always had this problem. But Ritzi Pesach Frank writes to Chaim Moser Grozinski, he has to proclaim, or he's asking him to proclaim, that the Eda Haredi is forbidden to exist and their Beis Din is forbidden to exist. What's the problem? From Ritzi Pesach Frank's perspective, there is a Rav Kook, and there's a Beis Din, and there's a Hashkacha. The Shochtim were under Rav Kook's Beis Din. Someone else comes into town, sets himself up as Rav of the town, opens a Beis Din. Rav Ritzi Pesach says that's forbidden. That's what happens now. That's what goes on. Obviously, it continues to this day. But he says that's forbidden. And if you look at the sources, you see this is problematic. The way it was in Europe is there was a Rav. Someone else couldn't just come in and set up a Beis Din. This was the big problem with the Hasidim. The Hasidim started opening their own shtiebels and things like that. It was very problematic. And to open a separate shlita, that's also a real problem. Now, what's the answer given? if the halacha is you can't open up your own thing, you can't create a separate base, then the answer always is, well, the rabbi is not serving the people properly. He doesn't satisfy the people. And obviously, if the rabbi is a reformer, or if he's not satisfying them, then you can open it up. So their attitude was that Rav Kook and his Beis Din were Zionists, or were in league with the Zionists, and therefore they're going to open their own Beis Din. I think today we're happy with this model, the free market model. How many of us would like to be in a community where there's only one shul? But that's how it was in the traditional kehilah. That is, if you want to open a new shul, the kehilah has to give you permission. So we see where Tzvi Pesach was, that he wanted to shut the Eid HaCharedi down. As far as I know, Rav Kook never expressed such a desire to shut the Eid HaCharedi down. In retrospect, obviously, it would have been a good thing if they shut them down. As I said, if you look at what's going on in Beit Shemesh and the crazies, we'd be in a lot better shape. But they weren't shut down. And Rav Chaim Ozer replies, summer of 1932, the context is, here's the context, that Rav Sommerfeld had just passed away, and the separatists wanted to take someone to take his place, and they turned to Rav Mendel Zach, Rav Nachum Zach, who was the Rav of Riga. And they asked him to come and take over as Rav. On hearing this, Rav Pesach Frank and the other Rabbanim on their Beis Din send a letter to Rav Mendel Zach that it's Hasagas Gavul, that he's encroaching into their territory. He's not permitted to come and accept this position. And if he disagrees and he wants to accept the position, he has to come to a Din Torah. At the same time, he writes to Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, telling Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski to prevent Rav Mendel Zach coming, and basically to declare that the Eid HaCharedi has no authority from their private show. And Rav Chaim Ozer begins his reply by saying he stepped out of religious politics. So, then he reviews the history of the establishment of the Eid HaCharedi. He says to Ritzi Pesach Frank, this separatist community is now a fait accompli. And that if Ritzi Pesach Frank and the rest wanted to bring the Eid HaCharedi to a Din Torah, it should have been done years ago. It should have been done in 1921 and 1922 and 23 when they formed this at the beginning. When Rav Kook was declared Rav, and then they established, and the Beis Din, by the way, the Beis Din that Rav Kook was not Beis Din of was the traditional, continuation of the traditional Beis Din, at least so they thought, they should have then taken them to a Din Torah. But now, 10 years later, when it's already been established, to take them to a Din Torah, there's already a Kehila. And Rav Chaim Ozer goes up, that's his ideology. He says he knows why Rav Kook didn't separate. Rav Kook never wanted to have a separatist community because he believed that you should have influence on the whole community. Rav Chaim Ozer says that it's a good thing to have a separatist community. He says this even though there wasn't such a thing as a separatist community in Eastern Europe. He says it's a good thing to have a separatist community in addition to the general community, just like in Germany, because the unified community, look, at the end of the day, 99% of the people are going to be in the unified community. Separatist communities are very small, 95%. But as long as you have a separatist community, and the non-religious know that you can always withdraw from the general community, that is, stop paying taxes and all, and join the separatist community, this encourages them to be more responsive to the Orthodox community. So Rav Chaim Ozer sees it as a positive thing, that the non-religious will be more responsive to the Orthodox if there is a separatist community. That doesn't mean that everyone should join it, and none of the people coming from Poland or Lithuania to the land of Israel joined the separatist community. These were just Hungarians and people who had been in the land of Israel for generations. No one else wanted any part of this community. It's like today, who's going to want part of this community? They thought that these were extremist communities, but yet he still thinks it's a good thing to have such a community. This is the Auschwitz dispute that split German Orthodoxy. We will see next class what Rav Chaim Ozer says. He was asked about the German Auschwitz question also. Rav Chaim Ozer also says that it's good to have people who are more extreme and straightforward in their religious approach. That is, his first reason why a separatist community is important is that it keeps the non-religious in line. The second reason is that it keeps the religious in line. He says that those who are in the general community, they have to be more polite, as it were. They're dealing with the non-religious. It's good to have people who are on the extreme, who are not working with the non-religious on a day-to-day basis, and they can be more straightforward. That is, the Orthodox who have to live in the real world, live with the non-religious, there's a chance that their values could be watered down. They could become too cozy, non-religious. So there, if you, as long as you have these people on the right who are always screaming and making trouble and things like that, you can always, they keep you honest. You're not going to be part of that community, but knowing they're there and that they're going to criticize you if you ever do go too far to the left or ever make any sort of compromises. Now, lots of times that criticism can be nonsense. You can ignore it. But the fact that they're criticizing you, and sometimes they could be on the mark, that keeps you on the straight and narrow. So Rav Chaim Moser actually sees great value for there to be a separatist community, something, or see Pastor Frank, if you read his letter to Rav Chaim Hirschenson, he just thinks that these are a bunch of annoying people. The best thing would be to get rid of them all. No, Rav Chaim Moser sees value. As we'll see, he sees value in Germany as well. Therefore, he says to Rav Chaim Frank, rather than trying to prevent the Eda Haredit from appointing a rabbi, you should be trying to assist them, work together, assist them in strengthening religion. All the rabbis should join together in matters strengthening religion. Now, this is very nice for Rav Chaim Moser to say this in Vilna. The fact is that it was impossible because the Eda Haredit would have nothing to do with the other rabbanim. Part of their extremism and their purity, as it were, was that they would not dirty their hands by joining with them. This isn't like the separatists in Germany, where the Gemeinde rabbis and the separatists could get along and agree to do certain things together. This wasn't like the rabbis in Eastern Europe. The rabbis in Israel, in the land of Israel, the separatist rabbis were very extreme. They didn't regard Rav Pesach Frank as a valid rabbi. So they weren't going to have anything to do with him. And Rav Kook certainly wasn't a valid rabbi. So, as I said, it's very nice for Rav Chaim Moser to say that, but the address of this letter should have been to the Eda Haredit, and Rav Chaim Moser doesn't have nothing to do with the Eda Haredit. His community was the Lithuanian community. That is Rav Kook and Rav Pesach Frank, something sort of tied into this, not ideologically, but organizationally, tied in with the Eda Haredit. And if you read Rav Pesach Frank's letter, there really was no way to deal with these people, Eda Haredit. They just march to their own beat, just like today. I mentioned last week, these crazy rabbis in Beit Shemesh and elsewhere, you can't talk to them. You can't go to them and talk about the terrorists, you know, the people throwing the rocks, the people beating up the kids, the people burning things. There was one of the rabbanim who went to speak to them, Beit Shemesh. He came back saying it's like they're from a different planet. I mean, things that all of us, things that every normal Haredi person takes for granted. You don't burn garbage cans, it's Geneva. You don't break people's cars. You don't throw rocks. You don't beat up kids. I mean, in those communities, this is just apparently normal. And the rabbis say nothing about it. So if you read Rav Pesach Frank's letter to Rav Chaim Hirschenson, you get a sense that the inmates were running the asylum. He describes how these young people, the wild people, would come and they would take Rav Chaim Yosef Zonnenfeld's stamper and they would create whatever placards or proclamations they want, and they would do whatever they wanted. And so that's the situation. Having said this, let me read you what this book says. The Art Scroll book on Rav Chaim Moser Grusinski. The Art Scroll book on Rav Chaim Moser on page 199 says as follows. It is such sheker. It is such a lie. It talks about separatism of talking about the separatists. Actually, it's talking about Ritzi Pesach, what I just mentioned here, how Ritzi Pesach Frank wanted this to be shut down. Does it mention Ritzi Pesach Frank here? I don't know if it mentions, it doesn't mention, oh yeah, it mentioned Rav Pesach Frank, asking the Rav Chaim Moser to stop the Eda Haredit. It says as follows, talking about the formation of the Eda Haredit. In response, Jerusalem's Eda Haredus, it should be a Haredis, not Haredus, but, formed an independent base in 1919. 1 year later, Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was officially declared Av Beis and Rav of Jerusalem. Throughout the 1920s, efforts at unity among the two Orthodox factions were attempted without success. Rabbi Kook remained the official chief rabbi, while the Eda, under whose banner most of Jerusalem's community aligned themselves, recognized Rabbi Zonnenfeld as their Rav. This is false, false, false. Most of Jerusalem's Torah community did not align themselves with Rav Zonnenfeld. The Litvisha world, I'm talking about the Chevron Yeshiva, the Yitzchayim Yeshiva, the Mea Sha'arim Yeshiva, Oros Chaim, all the great yeshivas, none of them align themselves with Rosenfeld. Look at the letters. Who signed the letters appointing Rav Kook, asking him to become chief rabbi of Jerusalem? It was the entire Litvish world in the land of Israel. This doesn't mean that they agreed with everything Rav Kook said or stood for. They didn't. Even members of Zal Basin did not believe in everything he said. But everyone, basically, in the Torah community regarded Rav Kook as the Rav. This is indisputable. There was an Eda Charedit. There was a separatist community. But this was a minority. It was a small group. The great figures, the great Torah scholars, the names that everyone knows, Rav Zalman, Rav Tukachinsky, the Auerbach family, the Alyosha family, Rabbi Ram, the people we all know, they were all in Rav Kook's camp. The Chevron Yeshiva, you can go on and on. Litvaks, even if they disagree with some ideological thing, are going to remain with the Litvaks. And as I said, I call your attention again to C.P. Frank's letter. And it's ironic, I think, because the ideological forefathers of Art Scroll is not Joseph Chaim Sonnenfeld. It's not the Yehuda Charedit, even though they published his biography. It's not the extremists. It's the Lithuanian Torah world. It's the group that later becomes Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel. The group that becomes Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel comes out of the Lithuanian Torah world, and they were not separatists. They believed in working together, and when the state is formed, they join the government, because that's the way they had done in Europe. Whereas the separatist community continues on its separatism. Art Scroll, they're not Nature Karta, they're not Satmar, so this idea that they identify with the Eda Charedit is a little bit strange, but just factually, it is incorrect. Description of the Jews. Hungarians, which are not a large group, definitely they were separatists, but not the Lithuanian Torah world, and not most of the old Yeshuv even. And certainly not the new people coming. There were a lot of new people coming. The only people outside of Jerusalem who had any relationship with the Eda Charedit, some people in Tveria, but all the Jews, all the rest of the country, they all recognized Rav Kook. Now, Rav Chaim Ozer's influence was able to be exercised in a way that a Haredi Gadol could never do it today. When YU opened up the Gruss Center, this was in the late 70s, early 80s, you have to look in the letters of Rav Shach. Rav Shach has a letter trying to stop it, saying that the people protest, we don't want this in the land of Israel, and no one cared. And why should anyone care? They're a completely different world. But if Shach doesn't want it, so what? So same thing with Torah College and the rest. Yet Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski's influence was much greater. And one time he used it, and we'll speak about it now, which I think had very negative repercussions. Obviously, at the time, this couldn't be known. I think that these repercussions continue to this day, and I believe that many of the problems of religious life in the land of Israel are due to the mistake that was made, and I have to say, with all due respect, by Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, it led to repercussions which, to this day, affect religious life in the land of Israel. Now, let me explain what I mean. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, as I said in the first class, was really the closest thing to a pope orthodoxy had in modern times. That is, not just the religious leader, but also the temporal leader, the political leader. More political power than any rabbi, and even with this, he's still in opposition. He wasn't able to become Rav of Vilna. Yet he had enormous influence over the rabbis, all the rabbis, even the rabbis who were not Agudistan. He had extensive dealings with Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. On two issues, not just the one I'm going to deal with in detail, the transfer of the rabbinical seminary to Berlin, but the first one, if you've read my book, you know it well, I spoke about it in great detail, that the requirement in Germany, beginning in 1933, that meat has to be stunned before Shchita. I'm going to spend a few minutes on this because it really shows the influence of Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, a matter that was exclusive to Germany, that Germany had great poskim, including Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg, yet a poskim from outside of Germany was able to shut down the poskim of Germany. So this international influence is really worth taking a look at. What's the issue? Obviously, according to halacha, stunning animal is problematic. Let's assume now it's usher, because when an animal is shechted, there can't be any problems with the organs, injuries. And when you stun an animal, who knows what goes on inside? You could do some tests, but still, the animal could be affected inside. Now, stunning was not new. It had banned in Scandinavian countries and Switzerland. But you could always import meat to those countries. In Germany, while you could, in theory, import meat, it was very expensive and difficult. So what to do? There's a complicating factor in that although the Orthodox might be able to do without meat, although it's interesting, today I don't think we'd have a problem, but if you read the letters of the time, they act like this is a shasat chak. We need meat. People need meat. The old people need meat. Now we know meat's unhealthy. We'd be very happy with chicken. But they make it seem like you need meat. The Berlin Gemeinde, the general community, their institutions, the old age home, the hospital, they always were kosher. And they told the rabbis that if they can't get kosher food, they're going to use non-kosher food. Patients need meat. So there was a concern by people like Rabbi Weinberg and others that the non-Orthodox who generally bought kosher meat, that is, those non-Orthodox who bought kosher meat, now if they couldn't get kosher meat, they would buy treif meat. So the thought was that if we could find a heter, permission for stunning animals before Shlita, we have to do that. But this is a big deal, because to change the way Jews have slaughtered, this is something that never before had been done. No permission had ever been given. So they decided to consult with the Gedolim of Eastern Europe. And who's the Gadol? Reb Chaim Moshe Grzinski. He's the one that you have to go to first. And Rabbi Weinberg is chosen, travel to Vilna to consult Reb Chaim Moshe Grzinski. And Reb Chaim Moshe says to Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, write your responsum. You can prove to my satisfaction and to the other great rabbi's satisfaction that with modern technology of stunning, that the animal, the insides of it, are not negatively affected in a way that renders the animal improper to be shechted, then we can find the heter. So that was Weinberg's job. And Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg said to him, however, that any decision, Rabbi Chaim Moser said to Weinberg, that any decision to permit stunning in Germany can't be a local German matter. It has to take into account the reality of the rest of Eastern Europe. Rabbi Chaim Moser Grzinski's eyes are not just on Germany. They're also on the rest of Eastern Europe. In fact, there was another case in the when it came time to the boycott. Many rabbis supported the boycott, even though German Jews were going to be negatively affected. They were going to be hurt because they were going to lose their incomes. The economy was hurt, and the German government said they would take revenge against the Jews of Germany. Many rabbis said, nevertheless, we have to fight against Germany. This is the only way we can, and we have to show Poland and Romania and all these other places that Jewish blood is not cheap, and to prevent them from doing negative things to the Jews. Reb Chaim Moser said that, in this case, he said, we can't save other countries at the expense of Germany. Therefore, he opposed the boycott, and I'll deal with this in the next class. However, in this matter, he precisely said, we can't only be concerned with Germany, save Germany at the expense of the other countries. The great fear was that if stunning was permitted in Lithuania, in Germany, then Lithuania and Poland and Romania, countries with large anti-Semitic contingents in the parliament, they would use this as an excuse to say, okay, well, we can institute stunning also. Look, in Germany, the rabbis don't seem to have a problem with it. Now, the other leading halachas in Eastern Europe, Rav Chaim Moser is maybe the leading rabbi in Eastern Europe, but he's not the only posek, but they all agreed with Rav Chaim Moser that they would wait see what Rabbi Chayak of Weimar comes up with. And this is not an easy case, as you can imagine. The fundamental question is, should you even try to find a permissible way to stun animals before Shlita? After all, Jews have practiced Shlita a certain way for thousands of years. The idea that Shlita is harmful, I'm not going to say harmful, obviously it's harmful, it kills the animals, but that it's cruel to animals, and that they suffer in all this, was a canard. And many people thought that even stunning animals, even attempting to find a way halachically to do this, would be to acknowledge that shlita is inhumane. And they didn't even want to go there. So that's a weighty consideration, and that Weinberg was at first not interested in finding a permission precisely for this reason, because it would show the anti-Semites that what they're saying is true, that it is inhumane. But when faced with the fact that thousands of Jews be led to eat non-kosher food, he thought that need to see what we can do here, and if there's halachic grounds to permit stoning, we have to do so. Now, I'm going to begin next class, and hopefully we'll figure out how to stop my face from keep opening up the way it has been. When we begin next class, I'm going to go through the whole Shlita issue and what Chaim Moser Grzinski's role was, very important. And then we're going to move to the way he quashed the attempt to move the rabbinical seminary to the land of Israel. Had the rabbinical seminary come to the land of Israel, a modern orthodoxy would have developed in the land of Israel that would have had enormous influence. It would have changed the face of religion in the land of Israel. And religion in the land of Israel is suffering to this day, because in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s, you did not have an open modern orthodoxy type of orthodoxy that the German rabbinate could have provided. We'll talk a bit about that. And then from there we'll move on. Maybe next class, I don't know, maybe next class we'll speak about his halachic legacy, which it actually is quite amazing. The man who was the most important halachic authority in Eastern Europe today, the most important rabbi in Eastern Europe, in the world, you could say then, because Europe is, I think it is fair to say in the 30s, the most important rav in the world, most influential rav. His halachic legacy is very minor. Only two or three responsa that he wrote which still have an influence today. So that, I think, is significant. The responsa, which I'll mention, are significant themselves. But the fact that there's only a couple, and he doesn't remain historically one of the great halachic figures, like a Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan Spector. I mean, Rav Chaim Moser, who really was in the role of Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan Spector two generations later, and even had more influence than him, in terms of halachic influence, does not have that at all. We will, as I said, we'll get back to that. We will not meet next week, actually. I will be in Eretz Yisrael, hopefully, God willing, next week. But we will be back in 2 weeks. They'll send an email out reminding everyone that there will be no class next week. So before I sign off for tonight, do we have any comments or questions? I'm glad that David Eisen is joining us from Copenhagen. Had someone join us from Tokyo classes ago, and now we have Copenhagen. Wonders of modern technology. Okay, in a couple more minutes, if there's a... I believe Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector had the influence. After Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector, I think we need to go to the Chasam Sofer to see someone with that great influence. And I don't know. I don't know of anyone before the Chasam Sofer. Remember, you needed good communication to have influence of that sort. I don't know of anyone else in medieval times. Maybe the Maharami Rutenberg, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi. But even then, I don't know. This is really a modern because you can be an international rabbi. You need to have decent communication, decent mail service. Obviously, we have a telegraph, and then you have modern communications. Like in the 20th century, you can have it. But I think the Chasam Sofer is probably the first rav who you can say really stands head and shoulders above all the other rabbis, and the other rabbis are willing to submit. I think you next get that with Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan Spector of Chaim Moser, and then after that, in the Aguda world, it becomes then a constant. You have Rav Shach, and now you have Rav Yoshev, and that's their model. It's pretty unique. How did he gain such influence? Well, was he the greatest sage? The Rabbitshover didn't think so, but he was regarded as the greatest sage. And it wasn't just that, though. He was the greatest sage, and he also was involved with Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisrael was the organization of much of East European Orthodoxy, they regarded Rav Chaim Moshe Brzezinski as the greatest. Yes, the Chafetz Chaim was the greatest saint, but Rav Chaim Moshe, first of all, he passes away in 1933, but Rav Chaim Moshe is really, as an active Rav, is the greatest, is regarded as the greatest. And so in that sense, he was both the greatest in the political way and also a Torah scholar. They regarded him as the greatest Torah scholar. It's hard to judge these things. Were there other people who were greater? It's not important. He came to be seen. He was regarded as the Rav of Vilna, even if he wasn't official. Vilna is the most important city in Eastern Europe, the Lithuanian world, that is, say Eastern Europe as well. And therefore, the most important Rav in the most important city in Lithuania came to be regarded, understandably, as the Rav. Who else would it be? What other city is important? Vilna. The Refinals was the Rav. The Chafetz Chaim actually received smicha from Rav Chaim Moshe. Rav Chaim Moshe is older, but the Chafetz Chaim needed smicha to go to get a visa, I think it was, to travel to one of the good conventions. He never had smicha. I mentioned this last semester. When you say, did he defer to him? No, Rav Chaim Moshe deferred to the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim was the great tzaddik. He was a generation prior. Rav Chafetz Chaim would defer to Rav Chaim Moshe. But Rav Chaim Moshe would defer to him. In practice, it mostly went the other way, Rav Chaim Moshe deferring. But each one of them would defer to the other. The Chafetz Chaim, though, thought that Rav Chaim Moshe was the Gadol Hador. Rav Chaim Moshe thought the same about the Chafetz Chaim. So. The Chafetz Chaim was really not involved in day-to-day activities of Aguda or anything. He needed a proclamation to be signed. He needed his persona, then they got him involved. But Rav Chaim Moshe was running the Vadi Yeshivos, he was running the rabbinic side of Agudas Yisrael. He was doing the active labor, political labor. The Chafetz Chaim was not doing that. First of all, he was quite elderly by this time. And second of all, he never did that. That wasn't his role. He wasn't a community rav. He wasn't a pulpit. He was chosen to be the figurehead he was because of his great tzidkus and his great scholarship. But he had no political role. And when we do, I think next semester we will do Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, you will hear something amazing. You will hear how the Or Sameach, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, was not one to, did not look upon the Chafetz Chaim the way that other people did. He didn't think the Chafetz Chaim was even worthy of making decisions for Klal Yisrael because he wasn't a Rav. And I will tell you a whole story. It's an amazing story. It's not an accident that Meir Simcha Meir Simcha is one of the only moderns who are mentioned by the Chafetz Chaim, or is it the other way around? The Chafetz Chaim is mentioned by I forget now, but there's a whole story about a fight that broke out between Meir Simcha and the Chafetz Chaim, if you can believe this. At one of these conferences, the Chafetz Chaim comes to one of these rabbinic conferences, and Meir Simcha says he has no right to be here, because he's not a Rav. He's not a Rav of a community. Next class, I didn't get a chance to speak about it today, but next time I meet, I will, a journal just came out last month, Shvat, this year, in which Rav Ariel of Ramat Gan explains what Ritzi Yehuda Kuk meant. If you recall when we did this with the Chazon Ish, Ritzi Yehuda said that the Chazon Ish was not the Gadol Hador. And Rav Yaakov Ariel will explain what he means by that. What does it mean to be a Gadol Hador and a Rav of a Kehila? And Rav Meir Simcha did not think that Chafetz Chaim should be permitted to have any involvement in policy for communities because he is outside of the communal structure and is not involved in the day-to-day things of how to deal with a community. And we will get to that next when we meet, when we have our classes on Rav Meir Simcha. If you want to get a sense of who the Chafetz Chaim was, you can read Chaim Grada again. And this man was regarded as a saint. And just head and shoulders above everyone else, but he wasn't. Part of the reason he could be that is because he wasn't involved in nitty gritty. If he was involved in nitty gritty, he'd have problems. He'd have to insist on things. He was able to be outside of the structure. The story with Meir Simcha is so incredible because Chafetz Chaim is such a tzaddik and hard to imagine anyone having a problem or difficulty with Chafetz Chaim. That's not the stories we're brought up on Chafetz Chaim. And yet this story is recorded in numerous places, including hagiographies. The Chaim Grada discusses the Chafetz Chaim in which I believe it's Shiva. It might also be Rabbis and Wives. I think it's Rabbis and Wives also. No, I forget. It's the one that deals with the rabbinic convention. I can't recall now which one, but it's not the yeshiva. It's another one. It might be, it could be Rabbis and Wives, but I believe there's another story just about the rabbinic convention. It's not Rabbis and Wives. We have a Chaim Grada expert here. I can't recall, but if you email me, Baruch, I'll get you the title of the book. It's not Rabbis and Wives. It's another one. Incidentally, his wife passed away a couple weeks ago, Chaim Grada. He has a short story. He has some other short stories. But email me and I will, I'll get it for you. It's the Aguna? I believe it's the Aguna. If I'm not mistaken, it's in the Aguna that discusses the Rabbinic Convention. Okay, thank you, William. I've read them all, and it's been a while, so it's hard to keep the stories straight in my head, which is which. Okay, everyone, good night. Thanks again for coming and for the questions. See you hopefully in 2 weeks.